All right, David wanted me to have a slide in the beginning summarizing what I was going to talk about. So I made it real fast. So first thing I'm going to do is give a little background on motor cortex connectivity. And what do you need? It's fine. So motor cortex connectivity and why it's more historically, motor cortex has sort of been thought of as just this output structure that goes straight to muscles. I just want to show that it's more complicated than that. And then I'm going to show it's easy to extract velocity from this cortical population of signals we record from motor cortex, and that it's accurate enough that it captures some of the psychophysics of drawing and arm movements. And then that we can actually use it to control external devices. And that one of the really cool things about this is that once you close the loop and give the subject feedback of the recorded signal that you're recording from, it actually leads to neuronal learning. You can watch these neurons learn, change their activity.
Two questions
Sure.
So what do you mean by anatomy is complex? I mean, there's kind of this canonical view of cortex.
Right.
And there's
So there's this view of, especially motor cortex, that the output is goes straight, only goes to muscles, and that there's sort of this push button, what Bernstein called switchboard hypothesis, so that a little spot in cortex lights up, and that obligates a muscle to contract when that spot lights up. And I just want to show that that's not really the case.
but I mean, is there something about the local architecture that's complex? Is there
There's
something that's
also the
different than
I was going to just show the route from cortex out, but also the intrinsic around in the cortex itself, the horizontal connectivity is also complex. There's a lot of inhibitory. I mean, I figured everybody knows that already. So there's this usual center surround in cortex, so that if you electrically activate a spot in cortex, you activate that spot, and then if you, because of the synaptic connectivity around it, if you use high frequency stimulation, you actually activate a network around that spot of inhibitory surround. And so that sort of artificially changes what's going on. There's a whole cortical connectivity in there as well.
okay, and the second thing, I mean, about velocity, I mean, you can, are you going to comment on how actually you maintain position?
How you maintain position?
I'm maintaining position. You're going to talk about motor cortex very easily coding velocity.
Right.
But I mean, a major behavior is the maintenance of position, posture.
Right. I'm going to skip over that. I can, if you want me to, I can talk about
Is
it.
that outside motor cortex? Is the maintenance?
Well, there's a couple ways you can
Maintenance
do
of
it.
position outside motor
There's a
cortex.
couple ways you can do it. You're going to hypothesize an integrator that integrates the velocity signal somewhere.
Somewhere.
Right. Or if you look at some cells of motor cortex and you go to a tonic hold position, when you're no longer covering up the signal by velocity and all you have is position, then you see that there is a position signal underneath it. Yeah. Ready? So that if you look at the one of the things I should have put up there is that these cells, all cells in cortex, all cells everywhere basically, even primary afferents, they don't code for just one parameter, they code for multiple parameters. Some are more heavily represented. When I say heavily represented, I mean that the variance explained of their change in discharge rate is more heavily weighted toward one parameter than another. The motor cortex is very heavily related to direction. There's another much smaller percentage of the variance is related to speed. You combine those two and you have velocity. And if you go down a little further down the scale, you have some that's related to position as well.
Wait, I get you. I mean, is related to direction in a one-bit way that it's the sine in front of the speed, or is related to
No.
position in terms of a vector?
In terms of vector direction.
So that's your statement you wrote is not correct, though.
Why not?
Because then it's easy to extract position and velocity from cortical communication. That's what you just said.
Why did I say that? How did I
You
say
said
that?
you give them an output that codes position.
No, I said you have an output. Here, let's use the blackboard, right? So if you say you have, if you're doing a multiple regression, right, and you're looking to see how much of the variance explained in your discharge rate is related to these different parameters. So you write an equation, and you go, rate equals A times, well, let's say direction, okay, plus B times speed, plus C times position, right? And you look to see what the partial R squared is of each of these.
Wait, the direction is just right or left?
No, it's a unit vector pointing in a direction. So this is a direction, that's a direction, that's a direction. Okay?
And speed?
Speed is the scalar of that vector. Well, no, I'm saying that the, not the C, well, right, it would be small, but if the variance explained of this would be, due to this, would be small. This would be a little bit bigger, and this would be a lot larger. Okay.
That is the detail. I mean, that's incomplete, because you have two vectors to the four parameters with two magnitudes in two directions.
It's not related to a physical entity necessarily.
It's the same path. I mean, and then the question is,
this,
is the motor cortex sufficient to specify the path and the move and the speed along the path?
I'll show you that it is. Okay? But I do it by integrating this vector. This scaled vector is the way I get my path. Okay? So I'm keeping track of the integration constant.
It's not clear how biology does that integration.
Yeah, that's right. That's an open question.
So you say that if you only look at the activity in the motor cortex without, like, on the time-by-time basis, you cannot reconstruct the current position.
I reconstruct it, but I keep track of history. So I have a memory.
No, I don't want you to do that. That's your procedure. But I'm saying if you just want to reconstruct it on the time-by-time basis, you won't be able, without doing integration.
That's right. I couldn't do it. Maybe someone else could. But with what I'm using, I can't. Right. All I get is the instantaneous vector. At each time slot, all I do is get a vector. Velocity vector, and I don't know what came before it.
That's right, but it's a vector, a position vector. You say vector.
It's a velocity vector.
You say it's a pure velocity vector.
A pure velocity vector.
Now, when you do,
I'll show you. All right? Let's go through, and I'll show you, okay, when we get there. And I'd love to talk about it because it's one of the interesting things. Just to review, I think probably you guys all know, but this is actually an ape brain. This is the central sulcus. Right in front of the central sulcus is the primary motor area, and then right behind is the primary sensory area. One of the interesting things, this is actually from the turn of the century. This is a map by Ferrier when he's using phoretic stimulation, just putting surface stimulation on the cortex at probably about 60 hertz. And he saw that these different parts of the body would contract. And it's kind of a nice map so that the medial part of the cortex goes to the leg. And as you go lateral, you go just along the body. So you go, you know, abdomen, arm, then you go neck, face, tongue, mouth. So if you were to draw it out, you'd get sort of this homunculus, a little picture of the body on the top. Or of a monkey, it would be a simunculus. So this is Wolsey. This is a little later. And you can see that this is foot. And then you kind of go in an orderly fashion up until the tongue and the face up here. And so that sort of reinforced that view that there's this little puppet, a marionette, up on the cortex, and that if you activated a particular spot, that part of the puppet would move. And that's coarsely about correct. It turns out if you look in more detail, there'll be a shoulder area here, there'll be another one over here, there'll be multiple hand areas. It's a little more fractionated. But generally, in a coarse way, it's true. And just to review a little bit about the motor cortex, one thing that's unique about motor cortex is that it has, primary motor cortex has these very large pyramidally shaped cells. They can be 100 microns across the cell bodies, and they have axons that go out of the cortex. And the other thing that, if you compare it to, for instance, sensory cortex, there's no granule layer here. This is sort of the receiving area in most cortical areas. So afferents come in, the synapse in this area. That particular cytoarchitectonic feature is missing in motor cortex, so they call it agranular cortex.
So, Andy, can you comment on what is the input from cerebellum? How does that project into cortex?
That comes in and that goes into layer 3, a little bit into layer 4, a little into layer 5. But that the area from the coming from the cerebellum doesn't come straight from the cerebellum. It comes from the thalamus. So it comes from VPLO, the oralis. And likewise with basal ganglia. So basal ganglia input projects to motor cortex, and it also comes into those same areas. It goes through an adjacent thalamic nucleus. So this is what the output looks like from motor cortex. So you have the motor area up here. It goes through the internal capsule, and it sends projections to basal ganglia. It sends them to the red nucleus and thalamus. And then it projects down. It goes to the brainstem down here to the pontine nucleus. This projects to the cerebellum. And then the medulla, it sends out to, for instance, you know, numerous projection sites in the medulla, and then it goes down and that goes forms the cortical spinal tract. So now we're in the spinal cord. It sends one projection ipsilaterally. It sends another one laterally. This is sort of the more famous one, although this one's pretty substantial too. And it turns out that in monkeys, anywhere from 3 to 30% of these projections go straight down and go into the ventral horn and synapse directly on motor neurons. And so this is sort of the, again, the more famous in all the neurology textbooks. They talk about this projection as being an upper motor neuron because it's just one synapse to the muscles. So you go from the cortex to the muscles. But I just want to emphasize that that's somewhat misleading because it's a relatively small percentage of the projections. And even those that do end monosynaptically on motor neurons, they end on a lot of different motor neurons through different segments in the spinal cord. So they go through a large area of spinal cord. And they end mostly, if you counted the synapses, they end mostly on interneurons in the spinal cord. By far, it's probably two orders of magnitude more connections on interneurons than they do on alpha motor neurons. And if you just look at one of these tracings, so this is a slide from Shinoda where he filled one of these axons coming down from the cortex, going down. It can synapse in the cervical enlargement, going to an arm. It can send all the way down and also synapse in the lumbar enlargement and go to the leg. It comes into this segment, and these are going to two motor neurons. In both, this one goes to the radial muscle, so radial carpialis, so it's actually a flexor. Another one goes over here, and it will go to an extensor motor neuron. So they even go to antagonists. It's not just the specific architecture. And the other thing I want to emphasize is just that even if you get down to a level of a motor neuron and you look at the synapses on a motor neuron, there's something like 100,000 synapses, inputs to these motor neurons. And if you go back and you count from any given neuron, there's something like 10 or 15 connections at the most from a given cortical cell. So the point is that you're always playing on this large background activity, and that any given input has relatively little influence on what's going on to make an action potential on that neuron.
No, is that obvious? I mean, could you just say that in cortex for a long time, and then you find out you get no PSP, so it's just having 10 inputs.
Yeah, actually, in motor neurons, I didn't include the slide, but it's obvious. You have to hit these guys pretty hard. So if you're doing intracortical microstimulation, you can't just put one pulse and get facilitation enough to get that. You have to put in these high-frequency things. And even when you're doing that, it's not just coming from one particular neuron. It's coming from a group of neurons around it. And you're getting a lot of indirect activation, so you're going polysynaptically as well. And then the way these build up, if you look at the way you facilitate, let's say you put in a series of shocks and you look at it and you look at the PSP intracellularly in there, you get this nonlinear summation. So the first one looks like this, second one looks like that, and the third one looks like this. So you get this real nonlinear. There's a lot of, you know, and this goes back to the idea that there may be gates in the dendrites that are being activated and all that kind of stuff.
This is not a matter of more probability of release when you get into facilitation.
It might be a little bit of that too. I don't think they really know on this particular. It's different if you look at the 1A inputs coming back and synapsing on that. It's a different. The 1As are more or less linear summation when you do that, and these are nonlinear. So there's a difference in the way those synapses behave. Okay, so I just wanted to give that as a background because I think it's pretty important in my mind.
I guess that's looking at motor cortex, but you're claiming that order 10% of the inputs to these cells are only coming from motor cortex. So what's the picture left with? Where's most of the drive to these motor neurons?
Oh, well, they're coming from a lot of other cells in the cortex. I'm talking about a particular cell in cortex, okay? And how much of an influence one particular cell has on it, one particular alpha motor neuron.
But superior cortex also projects to the spinal cord, and probably a lot of your anatomy I'm not familiar with. So, I mean, what's the sense of who's dominating the input, if anybody?
Well, I think, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I think most of the input to an alpha motor neuron comes from cells intrinsic to the spinal cord. So they're coming from interneurons in the spinal cord. Relatively few come from projection neurons.
Where's the amplification?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how that works. There's a proprio-spinal system that I'm most familiar with. In the proprio-spinal system are interneurons that come from a few segments away in the spinal cord, and then they project. And in the cat, that's really important because in the cat, the proprio-spinal system is responsible for the proximal movement of the arm. If you selectively lesion that, the animal misses the target. He's still able to use his distal fingers. So there seems to be an importance to that. And that's pretty controversial. Roger Lemon just had a presentation at Neuroscience Meeting. And he's pretty against the proprio-spinal system being particularly effective in primates. The anatomy's still there, but actually demonstrating a physiological usefulness for it is pretty difficult.
So when we hear this whole talk now about motor control, I mean, how do we view this? Do you say that motor control subsumes control over colliculus?
No, it's one factor, okay, in a network. The important thing that I want to emphasize, and we have other work I'm not going to show today, but is that when you look at this, you have to think of this as being part of a network, and the way this signal gets to muscles is through this network that's like a big switch. What do you call those? Those switches that you can switch multiple different ways to get through a network. So the route, there's another name, I can't remember. But anyway, it goes, if you were to trace the route that causal link from that thing firing, you say, look, given an action potential motor cortex, how does that get down eventually to muscles? That's sort of a non-stationary process, and the exact route is can change all the time. So there's not this obligatory hardwired pathway that it gets down there every single time. I think that's really clear.
So how do you reconcile this? If you want to catch something, you can do the light control. Now you say generate the signal in the cortex, it goes through different pathways until it gets to the muscle or nerve where it goes.
It's kind of, we'll show how it can be reliably. It comes down to this idea that you have a lot of cells active simultaneously, and that it's like a stochastic process. It turns out that this is true, this principle is true throughout the entire nervous system, even starting with the very first sensory input that you get in the finger. If you look at the primary afferents, they have the same property. It used to be thought that you have these privileged channels of sensory information, and so that, you know, you activate one particular receptor and it stays sort of discrete all the way up through the medial lemniscal system. Turns out that that's not a very good accurate way of looking at it. People are actually recording populations of neurons in dorsal root ganglia, and they're seeing that they have this kind of behavior where there's actually a population and a net sort of sum of the population. It's not specific to a given modality. It spreads out. Okay? So I think that's my sort of philosophy of how to think about this. And so we start out with, and again, maybe I should put the screen up for just a second. Do you want me to just blank it out? Here, let me just blank. So the task, when I was in my postdoc with Georgopoulos, the thing we were using was the center out task. And all right. So the sort of standard task that a lot of us use now is the center out task, where animal is holding a manipulandum in the original work, starts in the middle of a workspace, slides a manipulandum in 8 different directions, like to the hours of the numbers on a clock. And so, you know, you're testing, and then you record a cell, and you look to see what the activity of the cell does during this task. And it looks like this. So that if you look at the rasters, I need my long stick now. You know, there's a. There's a, you know, increase in activity when you move down in this direction, and the cell actually shuts off in the opposite direction. So if you were to just look at the mean firing rate of the cell in these different directions and plot it out, you would find that there's something that looks like a cosine function. So here's the peak. So in this case, that would be down to the left, let's say. Okay, and we call this the preferred direction. But the important thing is that this thing spans, this is a cosine function, so it goes, you know, minus 180 to plus 180, covers the whole directional domain. So that means anytime you move in a direction, the cell changes its activity rate. It's not focused in a particular directional area, so it's not just active in that and zero otherwise. It doesn't look like this, is what I'm saying. Okay? It looks like that. And so that has import in meaning that if one cell has this, then, and this is pretty typical of most of the cells in cortex, anytime you move, all the cells change their activity. And the other thing that's sort of important in this is that the worst part, if you're trying to look at it as a decoder, is the most inaccurate part is right up here. So even though everybody talks about, you know, labeling the cells by their preferred directions, this is actually the most difficult part, you know, because a little bit of noise and discharge rate, right, leads to a big inaccuracy in this estimation of what the cell's preferred direction is. And so if you're looking in terms of information theory, the most accurate information is where the slope is the greatest. All right, so that's something that a lot of neurophysiologists overlook. I know you guys are probably take that into account. And then, of course, the other obvious thing is that if you really want to estimate, use this as a decoding scheme, you can't really do it for this one guy, because you're going to be using this axis here. And you're going to say, what's the discharge rate? And I'll talk about this in terms of maximum likelihood. If you go, what's the discharge rate here, right, then you have at least two answers right here. So you have this ambiguous code. And of course, that goes away if you add another function and you use the combination of discharge rates, and you can get a more accurate prediction. And that's sort of the idea of the population vector hypothesis. You take the two things that, in order to do a good decoding, you need these multiple cells and the fact that they're so wide, and sort of the pleasing fact that all the cells are active anyway, so you might as well use the information from all of them. And that's sort of what motivated the idea of the population vector hypothesis. And so I'm not going to talk much in the beginning about these single point-to-point movements. I'm going to talk about drawing movements, because I was interested in sort of this continuous process of what's going on as we move. And if you just look at a point-to-point movement, it's sort of ballistic and sort of like an impulse.
Just a short question. You said this population vector is more than this, right? It's a linear reconstruction method. In principle, you could take the indigenous measure or whatever on your data and try to estimate the original position. So it's more, the population vector is a very simple way of reconstructing.
Yeah, it's one of the simplest ways, but it's based on the idea that when we use it, we use the idea that discharge rate is for all the cells is always contributing to the population vector.
The question is, if you do this optimal reconstruction, where you take the most advanced nonlinear methods to reconstruct the movement and compare it to the population vector, the question is this a big difference or is it small?
I'll get to that. Okay, because I'll show you an example of using a Bayesian method. Okay, so the way, again, just as a review is, so we take this, we have the animal working on, this time he's working on his touch screen, using his finger to move on a touch screen instead of manipulating him. And we have him do the center out task, where he starts in the middle and reaches these eight targets. He drags his finger along the screen to these things. It's a two-dimensional movement. And we record a cell, and we find that during that task, we estimate its preferred direction, just like I told you, by finding the peak of the tuning function. And then while we're still recording that same cell, we have him do a variety of other tasks. And these other tasks are drawing tasks. So in this case, he was tracing a sinusoid. And this was actually what he traced. And it started on one side of the screen. He put his finger there, and there's this little moving circle that always stayed in front of his finger. And he had to trace this object like this, moving in a nice, smooth, continuous way. So he just basically did this with his finger. And then as he did that, we recorded the activity of a cell. And this is the firing rate during this, as he drew this. And we divided it into 100 bins. And you could see that when he's moving downward, the rate of the cell increased. And when he turned around and moved upwards, it shut down, or it got much lower. And you can see this oscillatory change in activity. And that's because, remember, the cell's preferred direction is this way. When he's moving downward, you're moving the cell's preferred direction. It increases its discharge rate. When you turn around and you move opposite that, you get this decrease in activity. Okay, and then the way the algorithm works is you just take this unit vector and you weight it by how fast the cell's firing at a given point in time. All right, and then what we do is we have a mean value. If it goes below the mean value, that's a negative weight, and that just flips the vector over like that. So these are what I call weighted cell vectors or contributory vectors. And so you just take from this one cell and you get at what happens now when we weight this vector. You get the time series of vectors through this whole task. If we just consider this very first vector right there and we look at that, we put that down right here, and now we go ahead and record hundreds of other cells while the monkey does the same task. This part up to right here was done with one cell.
So all you have is the spike rate of one cell.
Right.
And then could you just say again?
Okay. So we take, this is our sample of one now, right? We have one sample of one. And we put that output of our sample, just this very first bin, we take that vector and we put it down right there. Okay?
You have a spike rate.
I'm going to construct a population vector. Okay, so I have a sample of my very first cell in the population vector. I put this down right here. Right. So now I record another cell, and it has a different preferred direction, right, for that very first bin and a certain length to it. Now I do that for, go through, and I do that for 300 or 400 cells.
These are all recorded in motor cortex.
In motor cortex.
So the other thing is, you sort of put by hand in this DC level, which is above and below.
It's the mean value.
The mean?
Yeah. I can either do it, there's a number of different ways I can, and I've tried. What?
When you multiply with the vector, you take the
rate. I take the rate minus the mean. Okay?
The mean over, just integrate over time.
Well, I do different ways. I can take the mean during this task. I can get, because I'm fitting a regression to this, I can use the offset from the regression. I can take the geometric mean over all the tasks. So this is one task. I had the monkey do many things. I've done it a lot of different ways. Okay, and then the other thing I do is I normalize so that I take the maximum amplitude, I call that 1, the minimum I call it minus 1, and then I normalize the mean the same way. Okay, and so that each contribution for all my cells, the range is the same for each contribution. So each cell counts as much as the other cell.
I mean, the mean itself is kind of funky, but the normalization, how do you think the animal works?
This was empirical, so we had a. It doesn't. It changes it a little bit, but not that much. For worse. Okay, but let me get to that because when I at the end of the talk, I'll tell you what else we did. Okay, to make this. This is for a large population. When you talk about small populations, then these issues become very critical. For large populations, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. Exactly what the details are that you use. Okay.
Let me just back up and maybe get to this, but if you took the guys that had larger firing rates, are they sometimes more accurate? Do they have less variance?
They are, when you look at the population reconstruction, you look at normalizing versus non-normalizing, you get a better answer if you normalize with large cells.
So they have more large variability? I mean, they burst here somehow? That they have more, if you look at variance versus mean, which is an all.
I know.
Are those cells somehow have a hot, have a lower signal to notice something?
They're point.
One cell, it's just mean that you normalize it, that doesn't dominate the population vector, you will do better job.
That's right.
The fact that it's firing more doesn't mean that it's preferred vector to be preferred. So
right.
They're
basically, if you look at the mean versus the variance, they're Poisson, okay?
But the guys that don't fly very much are going to hurt you because they have higher relative variance. I mean, you're also boosting up cells that don't fly very much.
Yes.
Putting them all in the
equal.
Yeah. But the point is that if you have a large number, right, the probability that you have noise in one direction is going to be, right, it's the law of large numbers. Works out. When you don't have large numbers, then this becomes a big problem. And I'll show you what we did to compensate for that later. Okay? Right, so I'm just trying to explain the algorithm. So we get this cluster now for just this very first bin. And when we sum them, we get the red vector. And the red vector is what we call the population vector. And that points along the tangent of the instantaneous direction of the movement. Okay? So now if we do this, and we do that for each bin, now we're going to add these vectors together. We're going to integrate the vectors, and we can recreate the shape. And for this task, the monkey drew a spiral. And these are real data now. And so the way this works is the white is the integrated path. The yellow is the population vector. And these are those contributory vectors. And you'll see that the shape, as this animates around, the shape of this thing changes, even though each cell remains the same in the population. So there's 100 time bins for the movement.
How long
this guy, this one lasted about 2 seconds. So each one's about 20 milliseconds.
So Andy, where exactly are you measuring? I mean, when it's doing this, a bunch of muscles are moving.
Yeah. So this is outside in and inside out. And those are actual data. So that's.
This is
This is what we created. The actual movement looks almost exactly like that. There's only one line. I didn't show the actual movement in there.
So at least the population vector matches this one. This is population average from the neural signal?
Yeah, this is just what I showed you. This is that algorithm. I just take that yellow and I integrate it. So it started down here. I just integrate it. That's the integrated path. Just what you saw.
Is this measured in finger region or elbow region?
This is proximal arm region, motor cortex. So shoulder and elbow. Well, this particular case was good. I mean, if you look at some, you know, depending on exactly how you do it, it's a little distorted, but it's pretty close. I'll show you. Okay, so it's about 2 seconds, it's like this.
See? Knows exactly in advance which spiral we come,
it's, he's tracing it. The whole spiral's
in. It's always the same spiral or a different spiral.
And so it's either inside out or outside in. It's one or two. That's right. He is overtrained on that.
No surprise.
Well,
supposed to trace something which he doesn't want to see.
That's right. That's not this task. This is a well-trained behavior. Okay?
Here, really, it seems like that's purely the velocity vector.
It seems that way to me.
On the other hand, this is this particular task, the velocity and the position vector.
No, because I did inside out and outside in.
Yeah,
right, so if you go around a circle one way and you go around the other, they're no longer confounded.
But there's just this kind of stepwise ambiguity. I wonder what it would be on the top.
Well, one thing I did do when I was doing this touch screens is, you know, we had that horizontal sinusoid. It's actually in the paper, in the old paper, but we had this horizontal sinusoid. And once in a while, so the monkey was never trained on this, I put a vertical sinusoid. And the animal would trace it. He wasn't very good at it, but he'd trace it. And I made a population vector from that, and it was pretty darn good. So this vertical sinusoid. And it was relatively novel. I mean, he didn't get it very often. And so it worked pretty well.
Actually, it comes down to the following. If you do this original experiment, just from different starting points,
right.
You get the same.
It's pretty close. I mean, Caminiti did that experiment. He found that there was a little bit of a rotation globally. If you look at any given cell, it was very weak. Okay, that's what I'm saying. There is position sensitivity in there, but it's very weak. If you look at any given cell, it didn't really match position. But if you do a global and you look at the whole population, you have very weak relationship. You have R squareds of like 0.2, 0.3. Okay, so
the same movement from here and from here, you have to activate very different muscles.
Exactly.
So now you say, how can the same
It's better than that, because if I record a cell on a given side, right, so I should tell you about these chronic recordings where we can maintain recordings for long periods of time. If I have the animal do one arm, do the center out task, right, now I have them do it with the other arm,
yeah,
and I'll record the same cell. The preferred directions will stay the same.
The
well, that can easily be. It means it's a higher order relationship. It's not related in an obligatory mechanistic way to the muscles.
There's a lot of circuitry between that and
exactly. Exactly.
Thinking.
Right. So that's sort of getting back to my main point, is you don't have this obligatory anatomical connection. It's some sort of huge network property that's going on here. And I'll demonstrate that again. I'll show you what we can make them do. Okay? You'll be surprised.
But that sort of doesn't surprise. You say it doesn't surprise you that the same activity in the cortex will lead to very different muscle activity.
Yes. That's the point.
Because of, I mean, in between spaces, this would correct.
And many guys work in parallel. It's not just motor cortex that's doing this, right? There are many, many other structures that have similar kinds of behavior during this task.
So you say that the information will.
We're just tapping into this thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we're just taking a sample from this particular area. I'll show you other areas that work just as well or better than this.
I want to understand the big picture. So the big picture now is that there is one piece in the brain which only controls the direction, no matter where you start.
It's not only direction, it's In this task, direction predominates. Okay, if you do an isometric task where the animal can't move and like that, and then all of a sudden force becomes important. Okay. So this is one task, and I'll just show you another task. So now you're asked, so you can see these are figure eights, and this is what the animal actually drew, and this is what we get. So you see, you're saying, well, it's too perfect. Well, that one's a little distorted. Okay, and it turns out that there's this time warp. I'm not going to get into that, but there's a time warp so that if you say, here's my prediction, how much later in time does that occur in the movement? That is elastic. Okay, there's not a fixed lag between that. And that's partially responsible for some of these misshapes here. Okay, so the thing I wanted to point out here is I wanted to get into some of these psychophysical relationships. So when you draw, there's a whole set of psychophysics associated with it. That basically, you learn, when you see me moving, you know that I'm an animate object. Okay, I move different than a robot moves. Okay, and you can tell animate versus inanimate. And there's this whole set of psychophysics that relate to that go out throughout the animal kingdom. One of these is that when you make these continuous movements, they look continuous, but they're really somewhat segmented. And you can look at zero crossings and angular acceleration. And when you get that, you divide these into these segments. And that's what we did. And this is true for human movements. And it's true for the monkey movements. And if you look in, so these are the four different segments in a lemniscate. And you get the same in the neural trajectories. And so, again, you could argue, well, these psychophysics are represented in motor cortex. The other way you can say is, well, it's just a good kinematic representation of what's going on in the movement. But anyway, it's present. It's there. And if you look at another relationship, and this is called the two-thirds power law, what that basically says is you slow down for a curve. As you draw something, you slow down, and you slow down in a precise way so that if you plot curvature to the minus two-thirds power against angular velocity, you get a linear relationship. And this is, each slope of this is related to the segment. So again, I color-coded these segments, and you can see that they're pretty well represented. So here's the actual finger trajectories, and here are the neural trajectories that correspond to them. I should, again, emphasize that when we create this, this is over a large group of cells. This is different monkeys trained to do the same task, and I added them together. And these trajectories are averaged across all the cells, all the experiments that I did. Okay. So these weren't recorded simultaneously.
So when you have to know the configuration for each cell.
Yes.
So you do first this kind of experiment for each cell?
Yes.
Okay. From some stereotype initial position?
Yes.
Okay. And then you draw. And then you find another cell and again you do this.
Yes.
All right. Where is this initial point relative to the drawing?
In the middle of the workspace. In the middle of the workspace. Yeah, we've done a little bit of that. In some of our earlier papers, we actually had the animals start from different places and make single movements. Okay? All right. So now, more lately, we've been doing three-dimensional movements. So again, if you do this center-out task in three dimensions, use the cosine tuning function, you get a preferred direction. And now what we do is we have the animal working in a virtual space. So this figure is in the monitor. It's projected down under this mirror. It's like a periscope. And it's stereo, so the animal actually has goggles over his eyes. And this thing appears to be floating in front of him. So it's this tube. It's like an inner tube that's stretched out. It's actually an oval. And there's this little cursor that represents his hand position. He can't see his hand. He just sees this ball, and he moves it around inside this ellipse. In this case, it's an ellipse. Other times, we have him do figure. We have him do different objects. He gets a reward after he goes around five times. So he's trained to do this five times, and he gets a reward. What else is there? We have an OptiTrack. So it's electro-optic, right? It's a little IRED. It's seen by three cameras and triangulated. It's very accurate. We get 10 millisecond resolution, and it's a tenth of a millimeter accuracy. And we actually put IREDs all up and down his arm so we can get arm configuration, calculate torques and everything. Okay. So again, here's the task. This is his cursor. He puts it in this ellipse, and he just moves it around in there 5 times. I'll show you a movie now of him doing that. So this is his hand position. This is a start position. When he captures that, then that oval will appear, and he'll move around 5 times. And if I have the sound turned on, you'll hear the cell firing.
May I put the microphone?
No, it's loud enough. There it is. So you hear that like a Geiger counter. And you can, fires right there. That's the preferred direction of the cell. Okay.
The motion is very chunky.
That's the movie. It's just the way we digitized it. It's actually very smooth. Okay. So here's the monkey now doing it. This is the marker that's on his hand. This corresponds to the cursor. We have these other markers all the way down there so we can get all the joint angles. So you can see it still looks a little chunky, but you can get an idea of smooth, how smooth it is. Yeah, that looks pretty smooth to me. Okay, and then finally, and this is for David, this is the cell we recorded right here. Now, David, you know, this is a single unit. We recorded this cell for more than 3 months with a chronic wire, microwire, same cell. I'll show you the data from it later, okay? We got more than 148,000 trials from this, and this is a discriminator pulse. You can see some smaller units in here, but we're just taking this big guy. It's 300 microvolts high. All right, single unit, don't need a discriminator. This is just a level discriminator. We're not doing anything fancy. Here it is. You can see it fire. All right, happy? Okay. All right, so you know, we're doing this task, and it's actually, you know, the animal's looking at this. He doesn't see his hand, so we have control over the visual input that the animal has. And we're, you know, there's the animal knows how to do this task by seeing the screen. And so the question is, how does the visual information get from, you know, his eyes basically to the motor cortex? And again, there's this complicated set of pathways. I'm going to concentrate on the so-called dorsal pathway that's more the velocity processing end of things. And the important thing is you go through this start right here. This is the interparietal sulcal area. This is, you know, Mickey Goldberg, Carol Colby's area, where they're looking at saccades and motion. And so this is the interparietal sulcus area. That's behind the central sulcus. And that projects to this area right here, ventral premotor, and eventually to dorsal premotor area before going to motor cortex. And so I'm going to record, if I want to intercept this visual signal, I can record from these areas and from motor cortex. And what I'm going to do now is I want to...
Can you go back a second?
Sure.
So, I mean, you made the statement that in motor cortex, your cells are controlled, that give you information about the velocity,
right,
enough fidelity that you can predict the trajectory and show us some
right.
So now let's move back one level.
One slide?
At what point does the predictability become poor, like, as a practical issue?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, and they've shown cells here that you can get population vectors from. I mean, Richard's shown that with these flow cells. And I'm not sure in MST or MT, but here you're getting, you know, if you're in, well, let's say you go to anterior interparietal temporal cortex, this is probably more position down here, right? This is sort of like the face cells. This is sort of like an object. So the question is, you know, if, and this is a very open question, if I present an oval to you and I say, trace the oval, right? What I'm showing you is this time-varying thing. There's no static picture of an oval there. It's sort of this time-varying process thing. And so the question is, you know, If I show you an oval, you know it's an oval and you know to trace it. So somewhere in the brain is there this static representation of the object, and that everything up here is a dynamic representation? I don't know. I mean, this is piecewise. I'm showing you a piecewise representation of the thing. So I can't answer that. All right, so anyway, I'm going around tracing this. What we do now is this, what I call motor illusion. So the animal doesn't see his hand. He just sees this cursor. We control the cursor, so we control this relationship. So what we do is he starts going around like this, and then the third time around, we change the gain of the cursor relative to his hand, and we increase the gain by the eccentricity of this ellipse. So we increase it by 1.8. That forces him to draw a circle now in order to keep this moving around in the ellipse. And so what he does is he goes like this, and then he starts going like this. And when we do this with human subjects, they don't perceive this change in what their hand is doing. They think that they continue to draw an ellipse. And so what we've done is, supposedly what we're doing is we're changing the perception of what's going on. So now we've dissociated with the perception of the movement from the actual movement, and we can go and we can record in a couple different areas. So again, here's the anatomy going in. We're recording from this area right here, and from this area right here, and from primary motor cortex. And so here, this is VIP, comes from the interparietal sulcal area, ventral interparietal sulcus, comes in here. This is more area 5, MIP, it's a different part of the interparietal sulcus, projects up to here. Motor cortex gets input from these areas, going this way, as well as from a variety of other places. And so we're going to compare population vectors during this task from here, here, and here. Okay, and here's our electrode penetration sites. So we have some on the dorsal, ventral premotor, primary motor cortex in there. Okay, and this is what we get. So this is from primary motor cortex, and the blue is what the hand did, the red is what we reconstructed from the population vectors. And you can see, you know, the first two are ellipses, and then it starts becoming more circular, and it always stays matched. So motor cortex, basically, it always does what the hand does, even during the illusion. Same thing, this is dorsal premotor, you get basically the same thing. But the interesting thing here is in ventral premotor, notice that the red stays elliptical, or oval, I should say. Okay, even though the hand is now circular.
There's only one data point, because the next to last data point, they're both oval.
Right here?
Go further. I know we're not really with memory now. It's really that last, everything you said is based on that last data point.
Okay, so if we look at eccentricity, right, we measure the eccentricity, and now we go through here, and we look to see what happens with the eccentricity. So the blue is the hand trajectory, the red is the actual, and you go through and you're trying to find out what's going on. And this is what I can show you, right? So these error bars sort of answer your question.
Well, but again, it's just the last point.
Well, that's the last 2 points. I mean, if you look at the different trends.
Yeah, the last point is you get one single error bar.
Yeah.
So the last point doesn't satisfy.
These are standard deviations.
95%.
It is 95%. This is a standard deviation.
Yeah, I can believe it.
Right.
It's just the very last one.
Well, you can see the trend here, right here. I mean, that's the best we can do. That's the design of the test.
I'm not saying that. I'm not debating your data. I'm just saying it's not.
That's it.
I mean, why didn't you try to start with an eccentricity? You said it was like, I can't read the numbers yet, but it looks like the ratio they asked you was like 2.
Yeah.
I mean, why not 4? Why did you start severe?
Well, if you do it too severe, then it becomes perceptible. So we're trying to keep it in that thing where we did the set of experiments with humans.
From 2 this way to 2 this way?
Oh, well, we have other tasks where more recent data where we're doing it vertically as well. Okay. This over here?
Eccentricity, yeah, seems to be lower than the second. Is that because you invert the axis?
No, when the animal starts out, right, there's always variability in what he's doing.
Yeah.
So there's That's why we had to do it 5 times. You know, otherwise we just do 2. But there, you have, when he starts up, you know, he's making errors. You know, he's not doing it. He's not into the rhythm of the thing. Yeah, it's always more variable in the beginning. Dorsal premotor, we didn't have that many cells in the dorsal premotor, so the population, if you go back and you look at it, they're a little more distorted. I mean, it goes also with the number of cells you have. So motor cortex, we had like 600 cells. This one, we had 200 or 189 cells. This one, we had about 250 cells. So you can see how nice that is in motor cortex.
You're saying that there's a calculation going on.
I'm just trying to say that if you look to see in ventral premotor, you can see this sort of the visual information dominating over what's going on. So it's like the perceived movement. That's all I'm saying. If you look now, I just want to digress for a second. One thing you can do in each of these cells is we can make a predicted discharge rate. So we'd use the cosine function. We look to see what the instantaneous direction of the hand is. And from that, we can get what the discharge rate should be according to the cosine function. So it's sort of a backward prediction, people call that. And if you look at, this is a motor cortex cell, and if you look at the actual discharge rate and the one predicted from the hand movement, you can get the lag between the two, right? So that's sort of like that prediction lag I was talking about, because the blue comes from looking at the hand movement, saying what should the discharge rate be, and the corresponding discharge rate actually occurred this number of milliseconds before. So I'm looking at this lag time, it's sort of a signature of what's going on. And I do a cross-correlation between these two and find the maximum. And the cross-correlation is a way of finding my lag.
When you compute the preferred direction, you compute the result.
Yeah, when I compute the preferred direction center out, we just take the whole movement time, again, average discharge rate. Yeah, there's no lag. Exactly, that's the key point. Okay, so if you look at this distribution of lags, these axes didn't turn out very well. This is 0 right here. You see a motor cortex is slightly to the right. It's a decent spread, but slightly to the right, meaning that on average the cell activity comes before the movement, and so the shift is predictive. In dorsal premotor, it's even more skewed to the right. In ventral premotor, it's almost bimodal, so that you have a significant shift to the left compared to these other two, so that a lot of the activity is actually coming after the hand moved in that direction.
How can you get 4 numbers to
be? 4 numbers?
Yeah.
Here? This one?
No.
Oh, well, that's the way they turned out. I mean, it's almost, it's like bimodal, I think. And one thing is, if you take just this half of the histogram and you make population vectors from it, it comes out even. You know how I showed you, let's see, whoops. See how this one is, this one's actually more eccentric than this red one. If I just take that half, then these come even more eccentric than if I take all the cells. So
when you do this again about the lags, understand what it's really mean. Because when you do this experiment, when you measure
right.
The different direction, you could also, you say you just take the overall rate over the whole movement, right? And that's how you compute the direction.
That's right. Right, the average rate. Yeah, and when you, well, what happens is that if you look at if you do that and then make population vectors, the population vector length changes. It wanders, it's noisy in the beginning, early in the movement before he starts to move, and then it locks on and it gets longer. Okay. Well, it's difficult because there's, right, what's difficult is if you look at the histogram of a lot of these cells in the center out task. Right, so here's 0 where the movement starts. You look at this histogram, a lot of these, you know, have shape to it. And in fact, what we showed in another paper is that shape is related to the speed of the hand. Okay. So there's So if you integrate over this thing, you get a good, better representation. You have to remove the time
so
pattern.
You can update it to break it into time.
Well, the trouble is you do, again, there's a spread of lags, right, for each of these cells. How do you know which lag to take when you're going to calculate it on a bin by bin basis? Yeah, you could. It just becomes very difficult because there are other factors that are contributing to this time pattern here. Okay. All right. So again, I just wanted to show that. What?
This means that there's a lag also here. So is it the same lag?
What lag?
So you say in this experiment the cell fires the most not at the onset of the movement, but sometimes during the
movement. No, if you take the directional information in the cell and you say when is that direction represented by the cell actually being carried out in the movement? That's what this lag is.
No, I'm talking about this experiment.
Oh, this one.
You say the movement starts at the moment the cell begins to fire on the main.
No, no. Well, oh, you mean these guys over here to the left of zero?
But the fact that when you compute the preferred direction, you sort of integrate activity over the whole time of the movement. Here you take it from a small family.
Right.
And
but I.
When you interpret this as being lag or non lag, maybe you're right. I'm just trying to understand. So here you
it fires. Usually, it fires before the. It changes the activity before the onset of movement.
What did this mean about?
It just shows that I was just picking an example. But if the peak velocity is reached there in the movement, right, that this will peak somewhere before the peak velocity and have the same shape as the velocity profile of the hand during the task. Right. There's a spread, predominantly before motor cortex.
Maybe it's a reformulation of this thing, but you could kind of optimize your population vector by inserting each cell at its preferred lag.
Actually, that's what I did do.
Okay.
Okay.
What
I showed you is what I ended up doing. Because I wanted to be consistent. And so what I did is I shifted all these so that they were at zero. So I took all and I shifted them. In that figure I showed you, that's what I did. Okay. They went plus and minus 200 milliseconds.
And if you don't do that, you get significantly
worse. No, it's not significant. It's a little bit worse. For ventral, it made most of the difference in dorsal premotor. In dorsal premotor, if you don't shift, you get some really weird looking stuff. Okay. Okay, so the other interesting thing is if you look at curvature during this task.
Can you normalize bin by bin?
I normalize bin by bin? Yes.
Every time you normalize the rate.
No, I picked a global maximum, right? The fastest over all my data for that cell.
Yeah, that's what you
need right. And again, that turns out not to make very much difference in these things. Okay, so I'm taking this ventral premotor cell now. I'm looking at the curvature. So this axis is curvature. This is time through the movement. If I look at the hand trajectory in the blue and I look at the curvature, you see that the corresponding curvature occurred after the movement did. Again, so this is ventral premotor. This is the population vector for the ventral premotor. It actually lags what the hand does, right? So I'm thinking of this as visual feedback. This, as the illusion, so this is cycle 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. As the illusion becomes more and more prominent, you see this phase shift. And that's because, you know, what's happening on the screen, where the hand is on the screen in the ellipse, is a different thing where the cursor is on the screen is different than where his hand is. And so you get this big phase shift. Even though he's almost drawing a circle, it's not a perfect circle, so he still had this change. So this guy's drawing a circle, but since the arc length of the circle is different than the arc length of the ellipse, you get this phase shift. And they both have to end at the same time.
The motor cortex is lagging?
This is ventral premotor.
Ventral premotor is lagging.
I'm not necessarily calling it a motor control signal.
It's like a visual signal.
That's probably what it is. That's the way I'm thinking about it.
So this whole story, the vectors, population vectors, is a visual signal, not a motor control.
In ventral premotor cortex, right? I showed you in dorsal premotor and primary motor, it's different than that. It comes before the movement. Right? Okay. All right.
If you go back one little bit, this was ventral.
That was ventral. This is zero. There is a huge spread.
That horizontal is 200 milliseconds.
This one? This one's a few hundred milliseconds. Yeah. So 100, 200, 300.
That's a few hundred milliseconds preceding.
This is preceding, right?
By a little bit.
This one is preceding. The mean here is about 50 milliseconds, 60 milliseconds.
And the other one?
This is 200 milliseconds. Right there, this is 100. Okay.
And the other one is all over the map.
This one's all over the map.
But that particular data set, it just happened to be lagging.
The one that I showed you?
Yeah.
That was the population vector.
I don't see how that last data set is consistent with this figure.
No, this is all my neurons. When you make the population vector, that's what you get. Yeah, it lags.
It lags even though some neurons are early.
Right.
I don't see it. Oh, the distribution is flat.
Those that the neurons that lag are not the stars.
Somehow, yeah. They contribute more somehow to the population vector. I don't know how. No, it's the same task. It's just different cells. Each of these are numbers of cells along this axis. Number of single cells. No, this one are for each cell separately using that technique I showed you. The curvature one was for the population vector.
Yes.
Right. It's average lag. And you should remember, too, it's average lag of shooting the whole histogram. If you look at the individual cycles, as the illusion comes in, the lag changes, too.
Can you tell me again what the illusion is?
Okay, the illusion is that you change the gain of the cursor so that on the screen, what the subject sees is always the same. He always sees the cursor moving through the ovoid, although his hand is now moving in a circle at the end. So you start out, your hand's going like this. As the gain changes, you have to start moving in a circle to keep the cursor inside the oval. Okay? All right?
I mean, Alexander's point is correct. There's something missing that doesn't quite explain to us.
Why that lag is here like this?
Well, this is smooth, beautifully smooth theta.
Right.
And then the previous trace suggests that the two curves should roughly coincide in time. Like if the previous one, there's some lag, some are advanced.
Right.
So maybe those things are not that much the sun.
Yeah, I mean, but
so
then you'd like to.
But then
you should see that.
What?
You should be able to test Alexandro's comment, like because you do this thing where you figure out the position of each cell. You should.
The position of each cell?
Well, the coding direction of each cell. So
right.
You should know which cells have a higher variance and a lower variance, and that should.
Well, but what they have in the tuning task may not correspond to what they're actually doing here.
This is a strong statement that the cells that are advanced are noisier.
Are noisier?
Well, maybe
they're
less consistent between, but this population vector, which is some information of the different cells. So it's not just a matter of how it's noisy, how they are.
Yeah, it's noisy, and it also has to do with the depth of modulation of these cells. So when some of these cells are highly modulated during the task and others aren't.
But you normalize
it. But still, that gets back to your noise thing, right? So if I normalize something, if I have a signal like this, right, and I have another signal that the little ripples on it, I mean like this, and I normalize it, I mean, what does that do? So that these have the same amplitude.
Well, maybe this is a case where adding them up as normalized objects is a bad thing.
Could be.
So when you made those two red and blue donuts, did you take into account the gain that was factored in there?
The gain. That was it. That was what his hand position was in space. So the red and the blue.
So the blue is exactly where his hand was.
That's his hand trajectory. Right.
He's actually making a little circle, and the thing is actually right?
Yeah. So he's actually making this circle. Right. Instead of this oval, we change the gain. We force him to move from making this to making that.
So in motor, he actually knows that he's doing.
Well, the motor cortex follows the arm.
So the motor cortex
or precedes
the
circle,
him. But the visual, he's getting the feedback.
Right.
So you're saying that that's a feedback signal, not good.
That's what I think, right? Okay. No. It's a good audience. You guys are picking up a lot of things that most people don't.
Okay. You're usual. Congratulations on your very nice data.
Yeah. Okay. So again, if I look at the two-thirds power law now for the ventral premotor population, it never really gets violated, which was surprising to me. So. You know, we look at the ellipse down here. You know, you would think if you're drawing a perfect circle, there's no change in curvature, so it should be like a dot on that thing. But he's cheating a little bit. I mean, we can't make him draw a perfect circle. And you can see all the range of curvatures is smaller, that these are still linear segments. So it looks like the two-thirds power law for his hand is still valid. And for the red, it stays good for the population vectors. So it's like this two-thirds power law is always there. All right, I just wanted to...
To be a little honest here, if you go back, you need to extend the short segments and it should go through the origin.
True? They go through the origin.
Each of those little blue segments should break through the origin. The slopes are different, but they also roughly go through
the
origin.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Probably better than the red, but it's close.
Is there a geometric argument for this two-thirds power?
People have tried to do, you know, the acceleration, you know, like, but you can get it to fall out. But the thing is that's it's kind of cool about this relationship is that kids below the age of 12 don't have the one-third exponent. It varies all over the place. And as they approach the age of 12, it zeroes into the one-third. There's also a perceptual thing. If I were to do this, you know, and just had a blinking dot at the end of a stick and you're looking at it in the dark, and I kept the same trajectory, but I changed the places in the trajectory where the speed of the dot, so according to the two-thirds power law, I can make you see different things depending on how I change the two-thirds power relationship. So that.
But do kids have a perceptual two-thirds built in already?
I don't know about their perception. In adults.
Do they see inanimate objects as being animate differently?
I don't know. But anyway, there's a lot of debate. I mean, it looks pretty much like this is sort of a higher order relationship. It's not just mechanics. If you know, there's a debate, Tamar Flash, I don't know if you know her, she says that, you know, if you start out by minimizing jerk, so there's this old idea from Neville Hogan that one of the properties of controlling movement is we try to make them optimally smooth, so you minimize jerk, the next derivative of acceleration. She says if you take that principle, you can derive the two-thirds power law from that principle. And there's a big debate about that, but it turns out that there's certain things taking that derivative approach that you cannot do. So in other words, you can predict the two-thirds power. It comes back to, do you specify the movement parameters before you begin moving or continuously as you do it? And there's certain things that her argument will break down in anyway. So I just want to digress for a second. You know, I've been talking about the cosine tuning and the population vector method, and using this as sort of our touchstone. I want to back up and talk about maximum likelihood method for a second. And so we have this task where he's reaching to the corners of a cube. The monkey's actually reaching to the corners of a cube in 3D center out task. And we recorded this same cell that I showed you in the movie. So we recorded this thing like 148,000 trials over 3 months. And then what I did from all that data, I built these histograms. And so these four are the ones in the back of the cube. These four are in the front of the cube. And you can see that as you sort of move down to the left and sort of halfway between the two, you get the preferred direction of the cell. Okay, that's the maximum discharge rate. And so if I represent that now, so this is the tuning volume in Cartesian space of a 3D cosine. We can regress this and get this function, so you get this ball with a little dimple in it. This is the preferred direction. This is the cube that the animal's working in. And so if you start from the middle of that apple and you go to the edge of the apple in any given movement direction, and you take the length of that, that's how fast the cell fires. Okay? So it's a representation of discharge rate. And now if you...
This is again average of 1 microsecond per second.
Yes.
The number of spikes within the second.
Right. And this...
During the whole movement?
During the whole movement. Okay. For these data. And then so what I did is for each trial, I take the actual activity, and now I find relative to the preferred direction. So now this is theta, this is zero, this is the preferred direction. And now I just take all angles away from that and all my data, and I plot that on this axis, and I get a dot. That's what each of these little dots is, 148,000 of them. And then what I do for this Bayesian method is I go along the axis here, and I say for each degree, I'm going to get the mean here, okay? And that's what this jagged line is right here, okay? And so what I'm doing is actually, I guess, the forward method or the maximum likelihood method. I'm saying, given a movement direction, what's the discharge rate, okay? And that's what this jagged line is. The smooth line is my fit to the cosine function, and you can see for this cell, I get a really decent fit. This thing here is just because I didn't have any data right at that point, and you can basically figure out why I'm not ever moving exactly in the preferred direction. Okay, and then so one way of doing this forward method is I can say, now what I want to do is I want to use this as a predictor. So I can say, look, for each discharge rate, what's the probability that I'm moving in that direction? And so what I did now is I took a range of discharge rates. I go 1 to 30 hertz, 30 to 60 and 90 to, or 30 to 90 and 90 to 130. I took low, medium, and high discharge rates and calculated the probability of this. And what I can see then is that when I'm going at a low discharge rate, it's very unlikely that I'm moving the cell's preferred direction, and it's pretty likely that I'm moving away from the cell's preferred direction. That's what this shows. And when I'm going the moderate rate, I kind of get this plateau. I can't really make a good prediction. I just know that I'm not moving in the anti-preferred direction, but otherwise I can't predict it very well. And when I have a high discharge rate, it's pretty likely I'm moving near the cell's preferred direction. Okay, so that's one way of looking at that. But that's not really what I want.
Andy, the last of the three is not normalized like the other.
It's not normalized?
Because the area under the curve is so much lower.
The area under the curve. Right, but that's not the way it works. What I do is if you take each of these bins, right, and you add that up, you take that, then for each bin and you go across all those, it will be 1. The probability will be equal to 1. Okay. So this is the representation I like better. And this is actually doing what they call the reverse method, but this is what I like better, where I just say, look, I have a movement direction. I have a discharge rate. I take each discharge rate and I look at all the directions that occurred, and I say, given a discharge rate, what's the probability I'm going to have a movement direction in that? And that's what this is. So now this is polar coordinate system down here, azimuth and elevation. And the color now represents the probability in that. So if I take my low discharge rates, these are actually the target directions of my 8 targets in this surface. And so when I'm going at a low rate, it's very likely that I'm moving an 8, or I have a little spot over here and a little spot over there for this given cell, okay? And then when I have moderate discharge rate, it spreads around a little more. When I have a high discharge rate, I get concentration over here. And so, I mean, these are, from one cell, you can't get a real good idea. But this is sort of the best you can do just with non-biased assumptions. And what you really want to do is now take these and combine them with other cells to get a joint probability distribution function, and that should give you the optimal prediction of direction. The question is, you know, if all cells were completely independent, you could just take these surfaces and multiply them together. But if they're somewhat linked, then it becomes much more complicated. And of course, in order to get a good estimate of this, you have to have a large sample. And so this, we're able to do it with this one cell because we had 148,000 samples. But anyway, this is an idea of sort of a different way to do it. I just want to throw it out there because I like it. You know, you don't have to assume cosine. You don't have to do anything. No comments from you guys. All right. All right. Let's just switch gears now. This is another thing that I do. It's actually a different laboratory that I have, a different state, actually. A little bit, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I hope I made a convincing argument that we have a good velocity signal that we can use in Cortex. And so one other thing we can do with that now is use it as a control signal for external devices. I mean, if we really are putting our money where our mouth is, I mean, if we have a good velocity signal, we ought to be able to use this in a real-time fashion to show that we can get real-time trajectories and that people or subjects can control this. And so,
I mean, you gave us three signals, moderate, eventual premoderate, dorsal premoderate. Which is the more reliable signal?
I'm going to use motor cortex here. Although some of the electrodes are in dorsal premotor cortex as well. Just mixing them all together. They're not that much different. You have to do something special to really, really show any difference between them. I mean, they all have cosine tuning, they make population vectors, and they give you about the right shape. I mean, they work pretty well.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the brain.
Can I quote you on that?
I mean, it's sort of embarrassment, right? I mean, some people make their career on explaining how different they are, and you're making a career by saying for these tasks.
I don't know if I'm making a career on it, but I mean, that's in my hands, that's in my view, they look pretty darn close to being the same. Time lags are pretty different, and this visual input is a little different.
But one is giving a control signal that's leading very slightly in primary motor cortex. And in these premotor areas, previous arguments aside, you're lagging. So somewhere there's an interface which you think is computing that the difference.
The real experiment that I want to do is to record these areas simultaneously. Try to get cells that have similar, the bone-headed experiment, we get cells that have similar preferred directions and see how they change the relationships to each other during the task. Really what I want to do is get these simultaneous populations and say, okay, when one population is saying this direction, what's the other guy saying? Okay, and what's the phase relationship between them in a precise way? And I can't do that in this because they're different experiments. So, and that's really what I, that's the real experiment I want to do. Okay, and we're that's the next one on the drawing board. So. I've not recorded from, as far as I know, I haven't recorded from SMA. Yeah. All right, so let me show you what we're doing with this so-called neuroprosthesis thrust engineering. I'll show you a movie now. This movie is about 4 years old now. And what we did is we have this technique where we implant these electrodes chronically in the brain, and we can pick up anywhere from 20 to 70 or 80 units simultaneously. Okay, and so now we, instead of doing one cell at a time, we can do them all at the same time. We can do it in real time. We can get a control signal, a population vector out every 20 milliseconds, 20 to 40 milliseconds, depending what we want to do, and use it to control or get the signal and try to control things with it. So the first thing we did is on the right, you'll see the animals reaching to a series of push buttons, and these are kind of arranged. Right, let's say a patient can't move his arm. Let's say amputated or spinal cord injury, brainstem stroke, ALS, paralyzed, right? And we can take the signal from the brain and make a robot move, or... Well, we flash a target up there, and we assume that the subject's trying to reach that target. What we'll do is we'll have a cursor, and he's going to try to move the cursor to the target. Okay? All right, so what we did initially is we just had the animal reach into these push buttons that were arranged in a center-out task configuration, and... In another room, we had a robot arm, and we wanted to see the robot arm would move in the same direction as the animal's arm. This was just sort of a crude first try. We only did this with one or two monkeys, and you can see what we're doing. You'll see that it sort of works. It's not the best. The interesting thing is that most of the movements of the robot, this is now a multi-joint robot arm. This is sort of a gripper here. This is the gripper. And... you'll see that it moves before the monkey's hand actually moves. So right there.
It just moves before for the same time as this is that little offset peak between zero. This is a 50 millisecond.
Well, I mean, this group of cells, it's probably more. It's more. Typically, we have about 150 millisecond. If you just calculate the population vector, right, and the lag and all these other papers I did during a drawing task, for instance, it's about 150 milliseconds. If you plot the histogram out that I showed you, and that histogram is not necessarily a good representation of what the population vector lag is. Right. Okay, it also differs for drawing movements and point-to-point. Point-to-point movements, the lag, nature of the lags are very different. Okay, then it is for a continuous drawing task. All right, so anyway, that's what we had for that. Then what we went to is this virtual reality experiment. And so again, it's the same thing. It's a drawing. This is box. The targets are in the corners of the box. It's a three-dimensional center-out task. And this is all we've trained these monkeys to do. Okay, there's no drawing or anything like this. They just have to do this task. They don't see their hand. They're just moving this ball to the point-to-point movements like this. Okay, so here's the very first monkey we tried on this task. And what we've done is we've rotated and superimposed what the animal sees. So here's the target the animal's going to. Here's his cursor. Initially, it's hooked up to his hand. They're not matched up exactly perfect, but it's pretty close. So this is the IRAD on his hand. This other arm is restrained. He can't move it. Initially, what he does is he just reaches his hand to these targets, and then we change the condition. So instead of being this cursor being hooked up to his hand, it's now being controlled by the population vector output. I'll point that out to you. This is the second day this animal's ever done this task. So, okay, he's moving to these targets now in virtual space. Right there now. We've hooked it up to his brain. Now he's controlling this, moving this to that cursor, and he gets a reward when they touch. And that drifts away. We don't have any timing constraints on this, so he's taking a long time. And what he's doing is he's moving it. He registers visually what happened to the cursor, and he makes a correction. And you can see these are sort of slow laborious. Notice he puts his hand down. Right? He realizes that he's not really moving the cursor with his hand. This monkey did that. Okay?
So the yellow ball is the population.
This is the population, right. That one is the population. This is the target. See, now he's not sure if he needs his hand there or not, but you know, he eventually just sets it down.
But this is different than this population back there hovering around the ball. It's a very different kind of behavior. You stop moving the ball around.
No, we move it, but we give him a long time to get to it. I mean, he saw like six different positions of the target.
But you keep on moving the target around mentally, does he chase it?
No, we haven't done that. This is just the center out task. It's a target out there, it's fixed, and he has to reach the ball
to. At the very beginning, you were moving the ball around, and the monkey was chasing with
his arm. Those were just fast, they were target, he was making the movements faster, so we were changing the targets faster. This time, this task, is only the second day he's done it. We give him a long time to reach the target. Okay? That's just just wait. I have a lot more movies. You'll be happier. Just wait. Okay? So, this is the second day for our first monkey. And I just point out he could do this. Okay, here's another monkey now. Now this monkey is a second monkey. He can do the task better, but he keeps moving his arm. He hasn't dissociated the fact that he doesn't need to move his arm now. Okay, so he starts out. This is just linked to his hand. Okay, now it's brain control. We give him a larger target. He's still moving his arm. He hasn't realized that
the
he doesn't.
Brain control is the big ball.
Yeah.
And arm control is the little ball.
Yeah.
But you're alternating.
These were mixing, right?
It's not the same experiment as the two.
It's okay. All right, now he gets it. Now you see what he's doing is that the population vector isn't a perfect prediction. So what he's doing is he's thinking, well, okay, it's not going where my hand is moving, so I'm going to correct with my hand a little bit. So he's trying, he hasn't learned to dissociate, you know, that it doesn't make any difference if he moves his hand or not. Okay. You can imagine that if we had a perfect prediction, he would never know the difference, right? He would just, the prediction was perfect, the population vector, he'd always keep moving his hand because he didn't know he wasn't supposed to, he didn't need to. Okay, so this is sort of an interesting case. So that was about 25 cells we were doing that with. Now the recordings have deteriorated and we only have 7 cells. And there's one cell that's really strongly modulated, has very directional, and it's pointed up and to the right. And you'll see that he has to struggle with his other 6 cells to fight that one cell to get the cursor to move where he needs to go. So this is, okay, arm control. Okay, now it's brain control. And you'll notice that there's this jerkiness. Every time the cell fires, it kind of brings it up. And he has to, he's monitoring it visually. It's the length of the population vector.
It's brain control business.
What? Yeah, he gets a reward. Well, because yeah. All right. Okay. So this was a certain amount of progress. Not the greatest. Now, what I'm going to show you is some more recent stuff. This is a few months old. What we've done now is we've forced the animal to move much faster. So he can't dink around and just putz around. He's got like 100 milliseconds to reach the target. It's much more like when he's moving his arm. And what we've done is we've employed an adaptive algorithm that tracks every 8 targets, every 8 presentation, so a full set, we update the preferred directions. And we do that by saying, okay, how fast does the cell actually fire when you move to that target? And so we actually monitoring that. There's also another set of weights where we weight cells that have higher R-squareds that actually contribute more to the population vector, have more information, are less noisy. We give that a higher weight than other ones. And then finally what we do, and we found this to be very important, is remember we say we subtract the means when we do that vector that contributes, we subtract the mean value. What we've done now is we've given it one weight if it's above the mean value, a different weight if it's below. Because what happens, I mean, you guys all probably know this, is that when you're going downward, you have a lot less range because it's truncated at zero. And so we found it's real important to give two separate weights for that, and that makes a big difference. Yes.
You mean that it can completely change and become completely different?
The preferred directions change. It's still using a popular. That's right. Okay. Okay. And the other thing we're doing is now we're locking the animal's arms down. So both arms are restrained. You can't move either arm. All right. So first thing we did is we had the animal, we did the usual thing where he does the center out task, moving his arm. We get a set of preferred directions. We start with those. Then we lock the arm down and we say, okay, he's got to move this cursor now to that target based on those sets of preferred directions before anything's adapted. Okay, we just initial start. You'll see he has pretty poor performance. He's moving off we give him a huge target and he basically misses. And then we let this adaptive algorithm go. And after about 10 minutes, we jump 10 minutes ahead and you'll see the difference. The adaptive algorithm, every 8 trials, it looks at the weights, it estimates a new set of preferred directions for each cell, and it changes these weights depending on what the F value is of the fit to a cosine function, and, well, to this function with the new weights, where you have a different weight for the positive and a different weight for the negative. So it's how well we can actually predict what's going on based on those weights. So there's like 3 categories of weight. And a global weight for the cell, basically how well it contributes to the population vector. There's the plus and minus weights. And then there's the coefficients in front of the direction numbers. So we change the preferred directions of the cell.
But the global number is just for the normalization condition, right?
The globalization just has to do with the F value of the cell.
Wait, so you can add one more thing. Because before you said you take every cell.
This is different, yeah, so this is different. So some cells, the global weights actually shut those cells down. So for instance, we started with 64 cells, and by the time this thing is done adapting, it shuts out 17 cells, so we only have 47 left that are actually contributing in a significant way.
I mean, I kind of bothered. You started off the talk. You said you calculated the cell's modulation down, you normalize everybody's modulation.
That's what we did initially, right.
And then the correlation between the movement and the firing of the cell is related to the modulation depth. And that's kind of the
modulation depth?
I mean, as the arm moves in different directions, the firing rate is going to be modulated. I mean, that's a measure of how well the cell is correlated with different directions.
Well, it's a measure of how well it fits a cosine function, right?
No, it's a measure of how well it's correlated in different directions. Even if it was very sharp, even if it wasn't cosine, but it was sharply
right.
Modulated.
But the way we're ranking our cells is how well they fit a cosine function. Right? We're imposing the cosine function. This is still, I mean, we're using those as the weights that we adjust the length of these vectors, both the direction and how much that cell contributes. We're adjusting all those things on the fly. It's a modified, it's not the original pi, this is a modified population. Yes. Well, up to a certain point. We go a few minutes and then we lock it in.
But if you take this algorithm where you're weighting how long things fit a cosine curve or whatever else you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and you go back to your original experiment, and you reanalyze the data according to this fitting method, you get a better predictor or a worse predictor?
Well, one way to do it is this is what we're starting out with right now. We're starting with the old method right there.
No,
that's the old method.
Little small numbers of cells. And right. You go back and you collect
For small numbers of cells, what I said precisely was that for large numbers of cells, it's not that critical. For small numbers of cells, it becomes very critical. Okay? This is just empirical. That the monkey will be able to control. This is closed loop now. The animal has access to the output of our algorithm. Okay? We did that. Okay? So, at the point where we start the arms restrained part, you can start, it's an adaptive algorithm. You start with a completely random set of preferred directions. He learns just as fast as if we start with these. The error signal. Here, let me show you the movie. Let's go to the movie, and then let's talk about it. Okay. The error signal is he's trying to get this cursor to go there. Well, for my algorithm. Okay, so the error signal is, well.
Position or velocity?
No, it's velocity. So we say direction of the movement, right? So the direction is this, right? And we say, okay, what did the cell do when it actually moved, when it was, we assume he's intending to move in that direction. What was the discharge rate of that cell? It was now no longer, let's say the preferred direction initially was in that direction. Now it doesn't fire very much in that direction. It shifts over to, we see it going to a different direction. We change the weights a little bit to go toward that new direction. And if it's consistent, then we change it some more.
In my modeling, when I decode the information from the population, if I'm looking at a few cell or two artificial units, it matters a lot how well I decode it, what decoding algorithm I use. And whatever decoding algorithm, the amount of information is exactly proportional to the number of
Okay.
I mean, I still don't understand that because the matches were never perfect between the experiment and the model. So either that part of perfect fundamentally doesn't encode the velocity correctly, or there's some issue of correlated noise between the units.
I think that's
okay, ready? All right. So this is just starting with those initial set of weights that we had from the moving arm. And the size of the, okay, so now it's after 10 minutes of learning. And you can see that we reduce the size of the target so it gets 70% correct. So it's a measure of performance. They actually touch it for a little while. Yeah. And this is in 3D, right? So, I mean, he's looking through stereo goggles, so he's going to the corners of the cube.
So, we see the ball overlapping, the missing dimension is not correct.
When you see the color change, he's actually touching the ball. Yeah. Okay, now we're doing novel targets. He's never seen these targets before. These are targets he's never been trained to. And as you see, some of them, these are straight in and out. Initially, he had trouble getting those because he just had trouble telling if he was going in or out of the screen.
How big is the screen? What's all that? What's angle?
These are equivalent to 2-centimeter targets. Okay, so that was Now.
So that looks like the most impressive thing.
Yeah, well, wait until I show you the last movie. Okay, so this is performance. And what color is that? Green? Yellow? I don't know. Anyway, this is the mean performance during the day, and this is the best performance during the days. And you can see, and we judge the performance by the target size, because we said that so that he's always getting 70% correct. And you can see that he really learns. He gets better over days. And this is what's happening. This is the preferred directions. I'm going to talk a little bit more about how the preferred directions change. So the green is the set of preferred directions we got from the when we let the hand move before we started this adaptive algorithm. And the white is afterwards. And these are all the trials, just the estimates of the preferred directions. Or the discharge rates, again, these are the eight targets. And you can see that, you know, there's really a shift in the preferred directions. So here the minimum, you know, you can see where the minimum is. It's over on this side. And here there's a minimum over on this side. So the preferred directions really, and that's... Okay, so these are the four, this is one cell. Each of these are the discharge rates in one trial, each dot. And this is during the discharge rate when the arms are restrained, and these are the discharge rates when the arm is free. These are the four distal targets. These are the four proximal targets in a cube. Okay, and if we plot what happened to all the preferred directions that were significantly tuned in this sample, so we, you know, it has to have a decent fit to a cosine function or we can't estimate the preferred direction. And these green are from the ipsilateral side when the arm was moving, and the pink, whatever color it is the ones on the contralateral side. And you can see there's a little grouping of preferred directions initially for the contralateral side. Actually, this is where it starts. The star is where it ends. And you can see that they move out a little bit. But basically, all the cells change their preferred directions during this adaptation experiment. The intended target direction. Afterwards? Well, we've never gone back at the end of the day to actually do it, but the next day we go back and do it, and they're back to where they were. Okay. Yeah, the pre-adaptated, and then the cool thing is here. We'll get to it. So what? If you look now, if you take day adjacent days and you plot the change in preferred directions for each cell. So this is X, Y, Z preferred direction. Each one is a different cell, and you plot it out, what you see is that they're correlated. So that really they're changing the same way. If you know the preferred change, if you know the shift in preferred direction one day, you get the same shift the next day. Okay. So basically, you know, at the end of the adaptation, the preferred directions are the same between days of the cells. And the other interesting thing is if you same is true for the arm movement case. So if you estimate the preferred direction from the arm movement state, the preferred directions are the same from day, approximately the same from day to day.
And you never saw this under any other condition? I mean, did you ever test, like, have the animal have to do two separate tasks with its arm? Is there precedent for this?
Well, not in our, other people have seen it. Like Steve Weiss saw it in supplementary eye field as an animal learned a task. He didn't see a shift in preferred directions. He just saw cells becoming more tuned and less tuned as the animal learned.
So they never learned the better direction?
The what?
I mean, if they keep on coming back.
Well, see, so the question is, I mean, this is a learning algorithm. We don't let the thing snap to the new preferred directions. We kind of let it change a certain increment as he's during as the adaptation thing is taking place. So, yeah, it'd be a question of, if we just restrained his hands and went back to the preferred directions from the day before, how well he would done, would do, I have to check, but I mean, with Don Taylor is the one who's doing this experiment. We haven't really done that experiment. But
so when he goes back in the cave, he's not relearning his old directions.
Well, it's, you know, it's a question because, you know, we're only monitoring a very small sample of cells, and that's what he's basing his performance on. We don't know what's going on with the other billion cells, right, that are could be active during this task. They may shut down completely. They may change their preferred directions as well. to support the ones that we are recording? We don't know what's going on. It's sort of an open question. But to me, as a scientist and not as much of an engineer, those are the interesting questions. I mean, whether we can get a robot arm to move with this thing, that's okay, you know. We already know that it should, according to the data. But this is interesting because, you know, this is actually, we're watching things change in the brain. I mean, you can listen to these cells and you can just hear them changing. I mean, it's really cool. You mean when we make a predicted?
Check whether your estimated tuning changes over time if you only do it. So the question is, if you take a particular task, can you change?
You mean when it's not closed loop, when it's open loop?
Open loop.
Yeah. Well, we've done that. So every 8 trials, you just estimate a preferred direction.
Yes.
The cells, they don't change very much. Well, we've only done the center out task in this case. Again, you know, if I take the drawing task, for instance, and I do that preferred predicted discharge rate, that's kind of a test of the same thing. And if we had a big shift in preferred directions, you know, it wouldn't come out so well. We wouldn't get good correlations. Let's see if you catch what's wrong with what I said there. But okay. Anyway, so if we look at the daily change in preferred directions, there's a little bit of a, besides the day-to-day correlations, I mean, there's also a trend that the preferred directions change a little bit more. So if you look at the contralateral side and the ipsilateral side, over days, they tend to shift more and more as the animal gets better at doing this task.
So early, you train them, stop doing the task, they come back to the test the next day, they pick up what they left off, and they continue.
To shift a little bit more.
Shift a little bit,
yeah.
As the animal gets better.
Right.
It sort of reminds me of this. Asa and Dan Schultz have a paper. You had neurons that could be auditory cortex that could be tuned from one thing or the other thing, depending on whether or not there was dopamine present. Well, there was acetylcholine present, which you get sort of thinking during a learning task. It's kind of funny. It sort of reminds me of the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be this sort of long-term, I mean, the fact that the animal can learn to do this in like a few minutes, and then also over days he gets better, so there's sort of at least two processes probably going on. The other thing that's interesting is that the activity in the population becomes more consistent. So if you plot the average discharge rates of these cells during the task, one against another, so you do a correlation matrix against this, that they become their overall discharge rates become more correlated over time. So you just take all the pairs and you look at the correlation coefficients. They become more correlated as the animal goes on in the test.
In
days.
Days.
Okay, and the other thing is, you know, if we use this basic regression equation for our cosine fit, and we just look at the R-squared values, how well these cells fit the tuning. That also goes up in time. So if you look just during the hand control over these days.
MX was movement. Movement was velocity, speed.
No, this is just direction, right? So this is movement of the hand in the X direction, Y direction, Z direction.
But early on, you said about a third of the firing rate.
Not a third. But some of it is related. We're not even using that now. That's a more complete equation. We're just using the basic tuning function here. Okay. And so now you look at the fit, and if you look during the hand control, it doesn't really change over the days, but it gets better during the brain control part of it. So, because we're imposing that. I mean, the better the animal can fit our constraints, the better the cursor is going to move. And it looks like he's actually doing that. Okay, this just shows examples. This is just, I mean, different ways you can fit a line. Okay, so here's the last thing. So now This is a few more days into the training. And this is just raw. We're not picking any trials or anything. This is just trial after trial, the animal doing the task. And he can do this for 45 minutes. And just to get an idea of how good it is now. I mean, he's moving. This is looks like a hand movement to me. I mean, he's moving almost as fast. This is after training, so the weights are locked in now. Okay, so anyway, that's it. This will go on for, if we want to talk some more. That's the last thing I was going to show you guys. I mean, there are experiments. I mean, people have done this. Fetz and Finocchio had this paper where they looked at a single cell and they tried to make it fire in different relationships to single muscles, and they could get it to do just about anything they wanted to.
A single cell.
Pardon me?
Do you have an idea
of how? I don't. I mean, mechanistically. You know, that's an interesting experiment. For instance, you know, like I said, we're weeding out cells that. So we started with 64 cells, and we reduced it by, you know, saying that global weight goes down on some of them. So there's really only 47 at the end of training that are contributing. We haven't looked at the other 17. Some of those may be well modulated in the task, but they don't fit the tuning function. It'd be interesting to see what happens to those that are no longer serving as feedback to the animal. We recognize those somehow as doing something. Maybe they shut up, for instance, maybe they shut down. Oh, the other thing I want to point out is that when the animals are restrained, we put the arms in these tubes and kind of pipes, we monitor the EMG of those guys, and they're zero. Okay, initially, the first day, they kind of struggle a little bit, and we get EMGs. They kind of try to steer the cursor there. But then after the successive days, they just go. And it's not just us saying that, because Dawn Taylor, the student that's doing this, we had a big bet on it because she really thought that the animal would be struggling and contracting and trying to do this. So she really wanted to see the EMG. She didn't see it. So I won the bet. Yes.
Yes.
I don't know. David and I were talking about that earlier. I mean, there are... Spinal cord does a lot, but there is some evidence that in the brainstem there's sort of a switch. But you saw even in that one monkey early on, when just the second day of training, when he realized that he was under brain control, he just put his hand down like that. Didn't use it. All right. I mean, for an engineer, if you get something to work, you've made your point, right?
Yeah.
No?
Worry about robustness.
Well, I think that's pretty robust right now. I mean, we've done it in two monkeys. They do it every day.
But you get this funny feeling that this picture, can you go back and discuss this final result in light of this initial vector scheme? I mean, it became very popular, but you might say you changed the path and neurons were coded for different vectors. It's kind of surprising.
Well, we changed the, so.
What?
Yeah, it was sort of surprising. I mean, I didn't expect them to change like this.
It seems kind of deep because you don't think of sensory cells changing their tuning properties. You may be doing things, but in visual properties, you do.
I don't know. I think there is some evidence of that now. And people have shown that certain kind of tasks you can shift the orientation of those cells a little bit. Yeah.
But then you also run into a prosthetic problem because the monkey, you do this task and you record it from these neurons and then it's a new neuron and then you got to.
Yeah, but an animal, but a subject that's paralyzed is always paralyzed.
What?
Subject that's paralyzed is always paralyzed.
Paralysis of the task. Now suppose you take those same cells and try to have the monkeys do a different task.
What kind of different task?
Okay, I don't know. Chase, what's the antithesis of chasing a dog? Moving an object from A to B somehow.
It's moving a cursor from A to B. What we're trying to do now, so the next experiment, and I haven't shown you the, what we're doing is to actually hook this up to a robot arm, to have him reach out, get a piece of food, and bring it to his mouth. Okay, so it's equivalent to the center out, out center consecutively. And we're having some trouble because the monkey has a hard time conceiving of this robot arm as replacing his own arm. He conceptually doesn't understand that there's a coordinate transformation. So he sees a piece of food in the arm. Instead of bringing the arm to his face, he tries to bring his face to the arm, at which point the arm moves away from his face. So, we're playing games. We're playing some games to try to teach the monkey that. I mean, it's a real problem. You reach a certain point where the monkeys are just too stupid to do what you want them to do.
And you also show that the tuning properties are somewhat different. So the question then is, if you make the monkey switch back, so to say, so first you control with the brain data, then you control with the arm. Does he do a mistake corresponding?
Right. So, so is there a carryover effect? So-called catch trial type thing? I don't know yet. I really doubt it, because there are billions of cells that would be normally active in an arm movement. In this case, yeah, we're looking at 47 cells. Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. You're right. Well, we sort of, that's why I was saying, we sort of do that because we eliminate 17 cells and aren't contributing to the task. And we haven't done, this is stuff that's a month old or something, right? There are a lot of other things that, like writing a science paper that we're trying to do.
Do you have any idea how this switching works?
No.
Obviously, if these neurons have some causal role in controlling the arms, which I don't know, if they do, then there must be some kind of signal switching off.
Right. Well, there's the old Sherrington experiments, servo isolate and things like that, where there's actually the idea that there's inhibitory regions and excitatory regions, so you cut the neural axis at different points and you can get facilitation and disfacilitation. And there's probably something like that going on here. So there's a reticular formation that enhances cortical output. There's another part of reticular formation that inhibits cortical output. There's different... This is a ripe area of research. I don't know. Those are good questions. It doesn't bother me that much, but it bothers a lot of other people because people are thinking about the cortex as being such a causal player in all this stuff. And to me, there are lots of things going on besides motor cortex. So it doesn't bother me that much, but a lot of other people seem to be perplexed by it. Yeah, but you figure, let's say that this what we're seeing in motor cortex is 1/1000th of the signal that's getting to the spinal cord that's facilitating these muscles. So what difference does it make? I mean, really, in the big picture, you lose 1/1000th of your input, doesn't make that much difference to the muscles. In fact, there's experiments you go in the monkeys, you lesion motor cortex, you take it out, and a few days later, you can't see too much of a deficit. It's different in man, but I mean, monkeys, you take all the motor cortex out. And most of the movements, I mean, you have to look. What the monkey loses is fine control of his fingers. But as far as crawling around the cage, doing somersaults, all that kind of stuff, they can still do it. Well, that's, the point is that, that that's what I was going to, you know, usually I try to give the history of motor cortex. I mean, just because it's labeled motor cortex doesn't even necessarily mean that it's that motor. In fact, there's a lot of evidence out now. Everything that Apostolos is doing with MRIs and sequencing and puzzle solving, maze solving, motor cortex is active in all these kinds of spatial tasks. Even that, you know, completely removed from any kind of motor output. And, you know, so the label that we put on is a historical label. It comes from electrical stimulation, which is highly non-physiological. And there's a lot of other areas. So those motor areas, they project. Cingulate areas project. Parietal cortex, primary sensory cortex, has just as large a contribution to the cortical spinal tract as motor cortex does. 40% of the cortical spinal tract is made up from the parietal lobe.
Same thing going through the cortical.
And the SMA lesions together with M1 lesions.
The more your lesions. So, I mean, when I was a graduate student, we used to try to make spastic monkeys to do other kinds of experiments. And you had to take out a lot of frontal cortex to get spastic monkeys. If you just take out motor cortex, they recover. Everybody sees this. They recover pretty well if you don't damage the underlying white matter.
So where's the cerebellum all this? Basal ganglia? Where's the rest of the brain?
Yeah. Well, like, you know, this sort of stuff that Reza Shadmir's shown with the adaptation to force fields, learning experiments. So anyway, Reza Shadmir's done a beautiful set of experiments where subjects are moving a manipulatum, and it's a robot, and so they can put these Kurl force fields on. So as you move in one direction, you have imposed forces, and it depends, it's velocity dependent. And you learn these complicated force fields. And he has evidence showing that the cerebellum is intimately involved in that kind of thing. So when you're doing this sort of kinematic to dynamic mapping, cerebellum is probably important in that kind of thing. Basal ganglia, I mean, who knows? There aren't a lot of good experiments with the basal ganglia. You don't really know what's going on with that.
Is there a subcortical region that, or cortical region that could be the cortex and get this kind of predictability?
Yeah, well, there's a paper out. Klaus Peter Hoffman has done that. And they get nice cosine tuning for arm movements in colliculus. It's partly in the very deep layers of colliculus and partly probably even underneath the colliculus. And so, you know, but it's there.